Welcome to Entrepreneurial Insights, a podcast brought to you by the Society of Entrepreneurs and Century Wealth Management.
In this podcast, we'll have a series of interviews with accomplished business owners and entrepreneurs in Memphis, Tennessee. I'm Pearson Crutcher.
And I'm Jay Healy. Pearson runs the Society of Entrepreneurs. It's a membership organization founded to promote Memphis entrepreneurship and provide education and resources to business owners.
Jay Healy is the founder and president of Century Wealth Management, an entrepreneurial firm that can serve as your family's CFO. There are so many great entrepreneurs in Memphis, and their stories need to be told. Welcome to Entrepreneurial Insights.
Welcome to Entrepreneurial Insights. I hope you enjoy this conversation with Don Hudson. Don is an accomplished professional speaker and also an author of 14 different books, all geared towards entrepreneurs and business owners, including his New York Times bestseller, The 1 Minute Entrepreneur. Don has a lot of insights to share about how to grow a firm professionally and how to grow yourself personally. I hope you enjoy this conversation.
Good morning and welcome to Entrepreneurial Insights. We're so excited today to have Don Hudson as our featured guest. I've heard Don speak many times on many wonderful subjects, including his specialty of sales, but today's interview is about Don Hudson. Don's one of the founding members of the Society of Entrepreneurs and is a past president and has been the MC at the awards banquet every year for as long as I can remember. So Don, I'm real excited about this. This is going to be a lot of fun today.
Thank you, Pearson. I look forward to it as well.
Yes, welcome, Don.
Jay, always a pleasure.
Absolutely. So we always like to begin just by hearing your story, your background.
Okay. Well, local boy. I was actually born in Oklahoma, but I didn't care for Oklahoma, so I moved to Memphis when I was 6 months old. So I'm almost a native of Memphis. Not quite, but I grew up in Whitehaven and then went to the University of Memphis, then Memphis State, which I found out later was the only university in the world that had a major in sales. Well, I majored in sales under the legendary Dr. Waylon Tonning, and what a wonderful experience that was. And that induced me to get involved in sales training. I went to work for a training firm right out of college, selling enrollments and seminars. And that was a real kick and a real learning experience because we had to give speeches to small groups to promote our programs. Basically, I was starting off as one who was incompetent and scared to death. I thought I knew everything until I actually got out on the street and realized how much I didn't know. But I had a great teacher and mentor named Dick Gardner who hired me into the training business, and he taught me how to speak. He taught me a lot about how to sell, which, in addition to my personal experience and what I learned in college, proved to be extraordinarily helpful. And I worked hard at it for a couple of years. I actually got pretty good. And after a while, I started having people asking me to speak to their company meeting for a small fee. And I thought, well, that's kind of cool. So I started doing some of that as well. And then I slowly transitioned from being a seminar promoter, having my own company after working for the other guy for a couple of years. Then basically got involved in promoting other speakers and gradually got onto the speaking circuit from there. But I didn't do it by myself. I had wonderful teachers and mentors, and that was enormously helpful to me. You know, they say OPE, other people's experience. You know, we don't have to start over at everything these days because there's too much readily available information for everybody. And it was even true back then, and I guess we could fast forward. Here we sit today in 2021. I've now done about 6,000 programs in some 35 countries and written 16 books. So that's the career track. The thing that has been the major emphasis through all these years has been the speaking. I did over 100 meetings a year for like 35 years. And what a wealth of experience that was. And I got better and better through the years, and it helped me gain a little bit of notoriety here and there. It's been a fun run, and I'm very thankful for the help of many, many people.
When you started at the University of Memphis, then Memphis State, did you know that sales was where you wanted to go, or did you have any idea what you were thinking?
Well, you know, I had two part-time sales jobs, so I had an immediate interest, Pearson. And then I heard about Dr. Tonning and the sales major. I thought, hey, that's what I better do. That's what I'm in now. It's what I know, and it's what I love. So, yeah. And I've been the luckiest guy on the planet in terms of timing. When I was a senior, Dr. Waylon Tonning invited Dick Gardner to come give a speech to his class. And Dick Gardner was the owner of the National Association of Sales Education, the company I went to work for. So he came into our class, gave a great speech, and at the end, he offered tickets to his big seminar coming to town. Half price for students, $12.50 instead of $25. I got my little checkbook out and cut my check for $12.50. About 6 weeks later, I went down to the seminar, and it was extraordinary. It blew me away. Have you ever heard somebody speak who just had such a profound impact on you that you got chills while you listened?
I think that's happening right now.
Wow. I got the goosebumps when I heard Dr. Kenneth McFarland. And as someone wisely said once, goosebumps don't lie. That means something's going on in your system. And boy, it was with me. Dr. Kenneth McFarland was the most unbelievable speaker I'd ever heard. And I got goosebumps a good half dozen times during his speech. So at the break, when he was done, I went out into the lobby at Ellis Auditorium, downtown Memphis, 1967. I found Dick Gardner, and I walked up to him and I said, "Mr. Gardner, I'm Don Hudson from Dr. Tonning's sales class. This program is unbelievable. I graduate in 6 weeks and I want to go to work for you." Well, he was taken aback by that, but he said, "Well, you want to have breakfast at 7 o'clock in the morning?" He had a flight out at 11 or something. I said, "Yes, sir, I do." So I met him at the Shoney's on Park Avenue at White Station. And I met him at 7, and by 9:30, he had hired me. And he got on his plane, went back to Kansas City, and I got all fired up about going to work for his great sales training firm. I graduated 6 weeks later, went down to Douthat Carroll Pontiac and bought me a new 67 Grand Prix, $127 a month, man, and I'm heading to St. Louis to do my first seminar. And that's how it all got started. But, you know, there's a wonderful book written by Gary Keller and Jay Papasan called The One Thing, and it's about prioritization and what happens in your life and the impact that different events have. And there's one fabulously valuable takeaway from that book, and I've quoted them many times, and it's this: meaningful things that happen in your life tend not to happen simultaneously. They happen sequentially. And as they happen sequentially, one thing happens which was enabled by the previous thing that happened. And I can track so many things back as I look into my past about this happened to me because that happened. And because that happened, this then happened. You know, if we can really get on purpose and focused in our career, and we can carefully monitor what has happened to us, what experiences have we gained from, and what can we then project into the future in terms of trends, and then create a vision whereby we're going to make some additional things happen on purpose, which will be in sync with your career vision. So that's something that I think can be helpful to some people, and it certainly has been for me. Now, all that was going on accidentally in my early years, but as I look back on it, it's almost like somebody upstairs wrote a blueprint for me, and I think he's still got a purpose for me, so I'm having fun sticking around.
So I'm curious, based on what you said, what gave you the goosebumps? Was it what he said or how he said it?
The answer is both. It's been said that the greatest speakers have a profound message and they present it in a manner that is emotionally grabbing. And that's what he did. First of all, he was known as the Dean of American Speakers. He was absolutely eloquent. And his style and everything, he was 6'4", tall individual, smoked about 10-inch cigars, always wore a three-piece suit, impeccably dressed. And I mean, his presence was unbelievable. And then when he opened his mouth, he just really made a magnificent impression on people. But I was impressed with his patriotism. I was impressed with his concept of motivation and personal excellence. But his delivery is what just grabbed me and slammed me and made me just hang on every word. And he was a magnificent speaker, and to this day, I've never heard anybody any better. He was absolutely terrific. So I considered him an early mentor, and I'm big on mentoring, and I think I've had some great mentors. I can name a number of them. And I've also gotten into a concept of, as I've gotten more and more involved in writing books and, of course, building my own library of books, I have what I call literary mentors. One example would be Orison Swett Marden, who I think is the greatest self-help writer who ever lived. He wrote 42 books from 1893 to 1927, and the guy was a century ahead of his time. He was absolutely amazing. But you read a Martin book and you just want to jump up, run out, and go achieve something. He was unbelievable. So he was a literary mentor, and though I never did know him, I feel like I knew him by reading all of his books, and they're all in my library now, and I treasure them. So the mentors are so impacting on your life, and I would suggest to everybody who might be listening and anybody who you ever give any advice to in the way of a younger person who's on his or her way up, encourage people to grasp what's going on in their life. And I think the good Lord does not put people in our path accidentally. He puts people in our path for a reason. So don't be one of those people who sits around with opportunities whizzing by their head all day long. Be a person who's seeking a life of refinement, who wants to gain all the good ideas they can gain.
That's great advice. Well, you left and went to St. Louis, but what brought you back to Memphis?
Well, over this 3 or 4 year period when I was promoting seminars, what we did, Pearson, was we'd go into a city for like 3 months, call on all the sales organizations, stockbrokers, real estate, insurance, any company that had salespeople. And we'd call on the sales manager and I would present our program, what we're bringing in 2 months out, for example, and say, then we're going to give you a free sample. I'll come by and do a 30-minute sales meeting for you. And I gave him the title of what my talk would be and how his people would benefit from it. Then I say, in the last 5 minutes, I'll tell them a little about our upcoming seminar, like I just told you, and see if anybody wants to participate. And they'd say, well, okay, we'll take a look at what you got. Come on in. How do you look like Monday week? Okay, great. We'd put the meeting on the books. And then I'd say, by the way, we really don't recommend that you cover all of this investment for your people. We'd like to suggest they have a little skin in the game. And what about 90% of our clients do is put it on a 50-50 basis, where if they're willing to reach into their pocket for half of the investment in the enrollment, would you as manager underwrite the other half from the company? Yeah, we'd do that. Great. Anyway, that was our process, and it worked really well. So my first 1,500 speeches were little 30-minute freebies to promote seminars. But boy, what a great training ground.
That is. That's huge. You also said, I have to go back to this, because you said you'd had 2 sales jobs, and I'm very interested in knowing, what were those sales jobs?
Well, I sold real estate and men's clothes part-time while I was in college. My dad was in the real estate business, and I helped him on the weekends back when South Haven was becoming a really, really big thing. And there are more people buying down there than there were salespeople to sell them. It's like the gold rush. Wow. I mean, it was amazing. I can remember one Sunday afternoon, my dad and I together wrote like 7 contracts for house sales in one afternoon. But these were lower priced homes in those days, and people were just buying them like hotcakes. It was a great experience for me. But even prior to that, I'd been selling men's clothes during high school and kept that job into my first year of college.
That's great.
So got some good practical experience along the way.
So you knew what you needed to do to make a sale.
I think so.
How to make the clothes. The clothes, not the clothes. Does that make sense?
So is there a big difference between selling and teaching someone to sell?
Yes, there is. But I'd say an even bigger and most profound change that took place was the concept of one's selling style. Back in those days, in the 60s, 70s, early 80s, there were people who were still subscribing to high-pressure tactics. And you handle the objection, and you close the sale, and you say this, say that, and you'll get them like it was a win-lose experience. And all of that went away in the 80s and 90s, or at least the vast majority of it did. If you look hard, you might find a Neanderthal who still sells with high pressure, but they're rapidly disappearing because that style of selling really doesn't work anymore. Today, it needs to be a win-win experience, and a sales professional needs to always be thinking about how he's going to be a solid, positive resource to his clients. So it's a good win-win, and you build trust. And you don't worry as much about closing the sale and hammering down for a yes. You don't think about always be closing like they used to say. Today, it's always be asking questions. Always be learning more about the needs and the wants of your buyer. Build trust. The close is going to happen. The sale will take place at the appropriate time. Teaching that is a lot more palatable for people today than it was back in the old days of teaching high pressure. And, you know, I bought into that stuff early on in my 20s and 30s like everybody else did at that time. But the changes have been for the better. And teaching, it's a refreshing experience because you see people's eyes light up every now and then when you teach people a new skill or you give them a solid takeaway and they think, okay, I'm going to change some behavior. I'm going to do something different now. And that makes you feel great because it's reinforcing for the teacher.
Trying, real impactful for the student as well.
Right.
So that's wonderful. How do you have people that work with you that you, I know you've had different programs where you bring in other speakers and everything, but how do you find the best people to work with you?
Well, in establishing today who you want to have as your colleagues, I think it's more important than it's ever been. You got to have the right people around you. And they teach in leadership that one of the key aspects of the entire leadership endeavor is make sure you surround yourself with competent people and compatible team members and people who work together. I have the phrase I use that all of us is smarter than one of us. It's the concept of collective intellect. And if you've got a team around you where you can get everybody together and that collective intellect tends to blossom and all of a sudden you gain consensus and you come up with new ideas and somebody suggests an idea and somebody else said, well, that's great, but what if we did this with that? And they plus it and fine tune it. And before you know it, the group has come up with an entire new direction for a division of the company. So a lot of those things can happen, but you got to surround yourself with the right people for sure. Now, today, we've got a pretty streamlined organization. We do a number of different things at U.S. Learning, including produce our Prosperity Series, where we bring professional speakers into Memphis live and we videotape them, but we have a live audience on hand and create some really great programs from that. Also, I'm still speaking. Last month, now here we are just coming out of the pandemic, but I did 2 live meetings and 3 Zoom meetings that were paid engagements last month. But you know what? You got to roll with it and you got to do what your marketplace, you know, play the hands you're dealt, do what the marketplace presents to you. And figure out a way to turn on a dime and do what your clients need. And your delivery system might change and your subject matter might always be upgraded over time. But you're always thinking about the customer. How am I going to help them get from where they are to where they want to be? And that's what's been a philosophy that's paid off well for me through the years. I feel like I'm compensated to the degree that I'm able to help other people.
The pandemic, you touched on that, and it did change a lot of lives. How do you see that affecting going forward with big training sessions and big training seminars? Do you see that that will come back?
The answer is yes, Pearson. I think it's going to come back, but there's also going to be this concept of the Zoom meetings and webinars. That's not going to go away just because the pandemic's going to be over. I think that's going to continue to live, and as people in the past year have learned how to do that competently, there's going to be more and more of that going on, and that's fine. There's room enough for both. But I think it's going to be very difficult to replace the in-person big meetings, like an annual convention of a company where they bring their 200 salespeople together and everybody presses the flesh and you have seminars and breakouts. And there's a tremendous amount of value that goes on at meetings like that where you bring some good speakers in and some trainers, and that's coming back, I'm sure. Might not come back quite as fast as we'd like, but I think it's coming back.
All right. But I do think that you're right that, I mean, a lot of times when you do go to a great speaker and you're motivated, it would be a great way to follow up. I mean, you can use the Zoom meetings to keep those people engaged and remind them of what they learned.
Yep.
So it would be a great asset. Well, tell us about what you think is one of the best decisions that you've made since you've been in business.
Well, I'd say certainly accepting Walker Uhlhorn's invitation to be on the founding board of the Society of Entrepreneurs.
Of course.
I would say some of my best decisions have been making decisions to go the next step in terms of technology, in terms of delivery systems, in terms of maybe joining an organization where I will learn some things that enable me to be more competent in my arena. So I've always been one who's had a hunger for knowledge and new information. I've always been a voracious reader, and those decisions have been powerful for me because it's enabled me to become more than I was because I know more than I used to know. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So you're a writer and a reader, and you absorb a lot of information and then condense it down into what is helpful to share with others.
Yeah. And sometimes in my research, Jay, I'll get an idea from somebody else, and maybe I'll just get that idea as a thought starter, and I take it in a slightly different direction.
Yeah.
That's pretty much mine, where sometimes I'll just quote people because I'm just basically saying they're the expert and here's what I learned from them, and I give them attribution appropriately.
So if you had to mentor an entrepreneur who was thinking of starting a company, getting it up and rolling, what would be five books that you would recommend that they read?
Wow. I would read Michael Gerber's E-Myth, which is an entrepreneurial book. I would suggest they read The Five Dysfunctions of a Team by Patrick Lencioni. Danny Cox wrote a book entitled Leadership When the Heat's On, which is my favorite leadership book ever. I would add that to the list. A couple of additional books that might not be directly about entrepreneurism, but nevertheless valuable. Uncommon Friends by Jim Newton. He died at age 96 about 10 years ago. But during his lifetime, he was a friend and personal confidant of Thomas Edison, Harvey Firestone, John Lindsberg, and Henry Ford, and Dr. Alexis Carrel, who invented microsurgery. But anyway, these are people that he had a personal relationship for decades with, and he learned so much from them. But Danny Cox, who I mentioned, did a lot of training and speaking for Jim's company, and Jim's telling these stories over dinner. Yeah, Thomas Edison told me one time, make sure he blah, 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 blah. Gets a quote from Thomas Jefferson that was right from the source. And Danny was an Air Force pilot, and Jim said, yeah, I used to fly. Really? He said, who taught you how to fly? He said, oh, Charles Lindbergh gave me a few lessons. Can you imagine? I think I said John earlier, but Charles Lindbergh gave him a few lessons. And interesting.
That's very cool. I want to go back again. I keep doing this to you, but you did mention that you were one of the founders of the society. Could you talk about those beginning days and what you see of the organization today?
Pearson, I think the SOE in Memphis has been so successful and has had such a meaningful impact on our community that it's just very sad that every city of at least 150,000 people doesn't have a society of entrepreneurs. In fact, I think I've told you before, there ought to be some kind of a model we could create for people to follow in other cities, because look at the things that have happened. You know, for example, the friendships that have come from it, the things we've learned from each other. But I've got some great personal friendships that were originated in the society with people I probably wouldn't even have met had it not been for the Society of Entrepreneurs. I've gotten clients from it, business, over the years, and there are just so many wonderful benefits of the Society of Entrepreneurs. So you're recognizing and awarding people who deserve to be recognized and rewarded, and that's a great thing, and it helps them to become an even more powerful force in our community. And you're also setting up an opportunity for more people to learn from those who have been honored to be inducted into the society. Because now through your podcasts and your luncheons and all the various different meetings, and you've chosen several successful delivery systems, that's wonderful to be able to get knowledge and ideas and concepts out into the community that many, many people can benefit from. So I can't say enough about the fact that it was a great vision Walker had in the beginning, and it's become even more, even bigger, even better over the years.
Well, thank you. It's been a fun ride, that's for sure. Yep. It's because of having great members like you.
So, thank you.
Of all of the people that you've talked to that have mentored you, would you say that what's the best piece of advice you were ever given?
I would say the advice that I've received. Cavett Robert, who was the founder of the National Speakers Association and an early mentor of mine, I used him on my seminars, and he was very impactful in my early years, and he encouraged me to get on the speaking circuit. He said, Don, you're better in doing those little 30-minute meetings than most of my colleagues in professional speaking right now. Now, he was blowing some smoke, but he made me feel good, and he did encourage me. So I got great encouragement, and along with that advice, he said, Don, I know you're young, and I was like 24 at the time. He said, you got to start promoting yourself as a speaker. And the first fee-paid speech I did was in 1971, and early 20s, $150 fee for the Southeastern LP Gas Association in Atlanta. And I did a luncheon speech, and I guess it was pretty good, and got a good testimonial from the client, and I thought, you know what, this is pretty cool speaking for a fee. And Cavett said, he's the most generous guy in the world. He had a great spirit. He used to think, if you just give yourself away, give away your ideas, stimulate other people to profit from what you believe in and give them what you can that'll help them be better. He believed you could never outgive yourself. No matter what you give away, what kind of quantity of your givings, it's always going to come back in a bigger quantity. So he said, it's impossible to outgive yourself. So I've always believed in that philosophy. So, you know, I'd always tried to tithe 10% of my labor for community organizations, things of that nature. And that's one of the things that came out of that philosophy, which has been great advice. And I agree, it is impossible to outgive yourself. But, you know, I've got a lot of people who I felt like were mentors of mine. I've learned some different things from every single one of them. And maybe it's just one little tidbit, a small idea that made a huge difference. But those can be absolutely profound. So I want to encourage everybody who might listen to this to make sure you've got mentors. And here I sit today, 75 years old, and I've still got mentors.
What's one thing you learned along the way that you wish you had learned earlier?
Let's see, Jay. I would say one of the things as I look back, I made a decision in 1976. I got involved in collecting classic cars. And I had them in my investment plan, and I got a financial planner who helped me put this together, and you can invest pension or profit sharing retirement funds and collectibles at that time. And this doctor in Boston that had about a dozen collector cars sued the IRS. What audacity he had. And he won. And anyway, my whole investment program was built into this concept of buying classic cars. So I collected classic cars, and I owned about 185 motor cars in about a 12-year period. And I think I had as many as 36 at one time. I lived on some acreage in North Mississippi, and I built a big building out behind the house in the woods where I kept my cars. And I got really serious about that. Now, as I look back on it, I'm not sorry I did it because it ended up being the nucleus of my investment program that has served me well through the years. But also, I had some competitors. About the same time I got into classic cars, I think of one individual, a good buddy of mine by the name of Steve Brown, who produced a video series. And he specialized mostly in speaking to real estate people and training realtors. And he made $1 zillion selling his video program. And I look back after a few years, I thought, you know what, if I'd have put the time and energy that I put into classic cars into getting into the video-based training earlier than I did, I ultimately got into it, but I left a lot of money on the table. So that's one thing as I look back, timing, I had a lot to do with that. I might have handled it differently.
Sure.
I bet the cars were more fun, though.
Well, they were fun, but they were also very profitable. But I really did my homework. I would read my Hemmings Motor News monthly from cover to cover. And I learned a lot about cars from all these people I met at the classic car auction and that sort of thing. And I went to hundreds of them over the years, bought and sold a lot of cars. And I was pretty lucky. I didn't ever get hurt really, really bad on any of them. And I learned how to make money doing it. So I might keep one for 5 years or maybe 5 weeks or 5 months. But it was fun, Pearson. And it was also, it was rewarding in a lot of ways. I enjoyed it a lot.
What's the car that you enjoyed the most?
Oh, wow. I had a 58 Mercedes 300 SL Roadster with two tops. And that was the sister car to the old Gullwing, the original Gullwing. And I remember I bought that car. It had like 30,000 miles on it, and it was like new. It was in fabulous condition, red with red leather. And I think I paid $24,000, and I sold it 4 years later for $48,000 and thought I was making a killing. That guy sold it a few years later for $100,000. And that guy sold it for $250,000, and I don't know where it is now, but if it's in similar condition, it's worth about $1.75
million. Wow.
Oh, wow.
So that's one I wish I'd have kept. Yeah. Yeah, but classic cars have gone up more than the stock market in the last 40 years.
Yeah, it's kind of remarkable that certain cars fall into that realm where the prices go up and all the other cars depreciate over
that's
time.
That's right.
One question that we always like to ask, Don, so we've got to ask you too, is do you think that entrepreneurs are born or taught?
Well, I don't think entrepreneurs are born. I don't think salespeople are born. I don't think leaders are born. We're not born to be great. We're really trained to be great. Now, the good Lord gave us the aptitude and the attitude in so many cases for people who've become remarkable in their careers. But especially with the sophistication in everything today, there's so much to be learned about every market, every channel, every aspect of what's going on, all the products, all the deliverables, and things are so complex and so rapidly growing. It's about what you learn and what you're able to share with others in a way that's a win-win relationship. Quick story to that point. Terry and I went to a dinner party. This has probably been 5 years ago. And I'm not going to give you the name, but I sat next to a woman at this dinner party, and the host and hostess decided to put together where you're not sitting next to your spouse. It's a big, beautiful dining room and beautiful and elaborate table and everything with 12 people for dinner. Well, I was sitting next to this woman, and she didn't know me. I had heard of her, but really didn't know her very well. And she said, "Well, Don, what do you do?" And I said, "Well, I'm a sales and management trainer." And she said, "Sales trainer?" She said, "I'm in sales. You can't train anybody to sell. You're either born with it or you're not." I said, "Really?" And I said, "Well, let me ask you this question. How long have you been selling?" She said, "Probably 30 years. I said, "Do you think you'll continue selling for a while?" She said, "Yeah, I'd like to be selling another 10 or 15 years for sure." I said, "Well, do you think you're going to learn any new things over the next 10 or 15 years to help you be better?" She said, "Well, yeah, I'm going to learn some new things." I said, "Great, I'm the guy that teaches them."
Good answer.
She laughed. She didn't have anywhere to go with that one.
But. Did you offer a 50% discount to attend your next seminar?
No, I build value. I don't cut price, Jay.
No, but she was probably there and probably learned a lot. So Memphis is known for our entrepreneurial spirit, and you talked about the fact that the Society of Entrepreneurs was here and has been tried in a few other cities that hasn't really taken off. So tell me why you think Memphis is such a hotbed for entrepreneurship.
Sometimes something will catch on, Pearson, and it's really difficult to define why and how it came about. I think the Society of Entrepreneurs in Memphis had some magic to it. And I think it was an idea whose time had come. And I think Walker got the right people together, gave it the impetus in the beginning that it needed to have. And I think one of the keys to our success was that we were able to engage people who we really had to have to make it work. I mean, what would a Society of Entrepreneurs be in Memphis if Fred Smith wasn't in it, or a number of other people, and even those who were brought in posthumously and those who were with us in real life for a while who are gone on to their destiny now, great names like Kimmons Wilson and Abe Plow and so many great names, the Hydes, the Dobbs from many years ago.
But why do you think there's so many of them here? So many of those people that are entrepreneurial from Memphis, Tennessee?
Well, I don't think I can be convinced they're not also in Nashville or Denver or Baltimore. They're everywhere, Pearson. But what we've been able to do in the SOE is we've been able to put a spotlight on these people and do it in such a manner that it's been an inspiration to others and inspired others to get into entrepreneurship. But I think that the concept of what we have put together with the SOE is something that is definitely duplicatable in other cities. But you've got to have the right people to try to put it together. Your dad happened to be the right guy when he put it together many years ago.
Because he had the alarm systems for all these people, right?
There you go. Yeah, well, he had a good network.
And I think what you referenced there, which is the ability and willingness to engage with these very, very successful leaders, I think that's unique to Memphis, and it helps us expand our entrepreneurial network.
Yeah.
Yeah, I do think that Memphis is more accessible. I think it's a big, small town. I mean, everybody knows somebody that knows somebody.
Yeah. But, you know, there's an old story, Pearson, about the guy who didn't like the city he lived in, so he was going to move to another city. And he got to the other city, he's in his car by himself, and he got out to fill up his car with gas at a service station. And he said to a fellow filling up gas over here on the other pump, he said, "Hey, I'm just moving into this city. What is this city like?" He said, "Well..." Really wise man. He said, "Well, what were the people like in the city you left?" And he said, "Well," and he started describing what it was like in the city he left, and it was not a very glowing description. He said, "Well, you're going to find about the same thing here." And the basic premise is life is a looking glass, and we get out of it what we put into it. And there are many, many great cities in this country. Now, I love Memphis, or I would have moved from it if I didn't. But there are a lot of great cities out there. who could likewise have a great society of entrepreneurs. But they got to have a great leader who's highly respected, like Walker Uhlhorn, to put it together, somebody who's also well-connected to get the right people into the nucleus of it. Is Memphis special? Certainly in its own way. Absolutely. But I think it could happen in other cities as well. I think about, you know, how do you duplicate things and make a concept grow and be nurtured and to work as something that is replicable in another city or another market, what have you. And I don't think it's the where as much as it is the process, the what, and the people behind it. So that's not a detriment to Memphis. I've already said how much I love our city.
What excites you about Memphis right now?
Oh, right now I think things are happening in a cool way. Look at downtown. In fact, I was just driving down Madison Avenue day before yesterday, and I cannot believe the new apartment buildings, 3, 4, 5-story buildings. I bet there were like 10 of them, all new, some of them not even finished yet, but they're just going up like crazy. So downtown, midtown, they're prospering. You look out east with this great environment we're in where the hub of Memphis business is in the Poplar Corridor and all that sort of thing. Things are booming. I think we've got a really fine economy. Stock market's good. Things are happening. And in spite of the pandemic, a lot of people are making a lot of good things happen. A lot of smart people in Memphis who are out there working hard to do it.
One of the components to be a member of the society is that you have to give back to the community. You want to talk some about your personal community service?
I've been very involved in some charitable activities at the University of Memphis for decades. Big supporter of the College of Business. I also was instrumental in helping the sales major that I mentioned for many years back in the early days, and it unfortunately kind of fell by the wayside. We've got some people getting together now to talk about how we can get the sales major going again. And we have a new dean in the College of Business, and he's fired up. He said, let's do it. Anyway, we'll get that going again. I've been on a number of boards, like the Society, of course, and the Board of Visitors at the university has been a wonderful association. Also, things like Junior Achievement, Memphis Symphony, and MIFA, those are just some that I've been on boards of through the years. You know, it runs its course. I was on the Orpheum board for 6 or 7 years, and you kind of get into it when you get engaged. You get on the board, and you try to make a real genuine contribution, either monetarily and or with your intellect you bring to the table. How can you be valuable to that organization? So Arise to Read is one I'm very active in right now that's really helping young grammar school kids, first, second, third grade especially. We found out that if a kid can read at the third grade level at the end of his third grade period, he's got an 82% chance of graduating from high school, perhaps going to college, and definitely being employable. If they don't read at the third grade level at the end of the third grade, there's like a 77% chance that they will not graduate, they will not be employable, and they might well end up in a gang or getting in trouble. So I think it's one of the key things we can do in Memphis is what can we do to help second and third graders and fourth, fifth, sixth grade beyond that, help them learn how to read, help them learn how to have enough knowledge and capability that when they do become of age, they can be an asset to our city, to our workforce. But they don't have a screaming chance if they can't even read.
Oh, totally agree.
So we've got some good solutions working at Arise to Read. We got over 1,500 volunteers now who go into schools and read for these young kids. Anyway, it's a wonderful program. I've enjoyed that one a lot. So yeah, we got to give back, no doubt about it.
What do you do for fun?
Well, I've done a number of things. I was an aviator. I flew for 50 years. I had my own plane and used to fly to a number of my own speaking engagements. But sold the airplane and gave up aviation a few years ago. Well, hey, 50 years is a long time to fly, and I got about 7,500 hours and never put a scratch on a person or an airplane. I figure it might be a pretty good time to walk away. So that was the real kick. I've also been into boating and have enjoyed that through the years. Had a boat on the Mississippi River for a number of years and played a good bit of golf through the years. Not quite as active in it now, but that's always been a lot of fun too. And then, of course, my book collection. I love to collect old and rare books, especially self-help books. In fact, my latest book that I'm working on is The 1-Minute Optimist, and it's a 28-chapter book And each chapter is dedicated to one of the legends that helped create the positive thinking movement. The real optimists of the early days, like Martin, I mentioned earlier. Other names that most would recognize would be Dale Carnegie and Earl Nightingale and Napoleon Hill and Og Mandino and, some of those. So we're writing, each chapter will be about one person. So I start off with an introduction of that person. Then we've got like about 3,000 words that are excerpts from the works of those writers.
Oh, that's cool.
And then my co-author, Sam Pope, who's also my assistant, and we've gotten into this project together. He does the wrap-up at the end of the chapter based on what he's learned from that particular individual. So that's a pretty cool project, and it's also a great tribute to these people who've had an impact on certainly my life and Sam's, but so many other people as well. And our thesis is, if you read 1 minute every day from this book that talks about how lives can be changed through positive thinking and optimism and a great attitude, 1 minute a day is all we ask, 365 days in a row, you will change your life forever. We think when you get down to year one and you've pretty much gone through the book, just start over and go back through that same book. Just a minute a day was all we ask, but a minute a day will keep the gremlins out of your life because you'll have a better human spirit, a better attitude, more expectations, and more capabilities.
That's incredible.
It's incredible.
It's an exciting book.
It's a wonderful resource.
Well, this has been so much fun, Don. I don't have any other questions. Jay, do you have anything else?
No.
This has been so much fun. I really appreciate
it. It's been my pleasure.
So as much as I've enjoyed hearing your presentations, this has been nice to get to know Don Hutson a little bit better. So
Thank you, Pearson. We appreciate all the great work you've done for our society through the years, too. You've been a real asset.
Thank you. It's been my pleasure. A lot of fun.
You can smile and be sweet 1 minute and a taskmaster the next.
I've heard that a few times.
Thanks, Don.
Thank you, Jay. Great being with you both.
We hope you enjoyed our conversation with Don Hutson. If you'd like more information about Don, please visit our show notes.
Thanks for listening to Entrepreneurial Insights. If you enjoyed this conversation, feel free to share with your friends or colleagues. You can find more episodes or subscribe anywhere that you listen to your favorite podcasts. And of course, reviews are always welcome and appreciated. You can also check us out online at entrepreneurialinsightspodcast.com or bluffcitybusiness.com.